Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia, in for David Ford. On today's show, we take a look at some men and women whose passion for the arts inspires, entertains, and informs. First up, it's Rex McGee and the merry band of musical mischief makers that call themselves Cripple Crunk. Their debut album was released last summer, and with lots of concerts on their horizon, it's a perfect time to get familiar with the music of this diverse, all-instrumental band. Then we knock on the door of Faith Action International House and learn how to go from stranger to neighbor. Faith Action tackles the big issues surrounding immigration, but they do it in relatable and artistically inclined ways. Then we close out today's show with David Ford's conversation with composer and saxophonist Wayne Shorter. Wayne just became an octogenarian, but trust that he has not slowed down one bit. All this coming up after the news when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia, in for David Ford. The band Cripple Crunk started when multi-instrumentalist Rex McGee convinced friends from his annual trips to the Galax Old Fiddlers Convention to do a jam session-styled recording. So, like a jam session, there were no opportunities for overdubs. And on Cripple Crunk's self-titled debut album, which promises 13 doses of instrumental musical medicine, what you hear is what you get. Spontaneous music making by some great pickers, fiddlers, and percussionists. Rex McGee and his friends who form Cripple Crunk share a love for traditional Appalachian string band music, but they also share a passion for a huge variety of styles. You can hear these self-described extreme acoustic instrumentals live in concert on May 3rd at Five String Fest in Lawndale, North Carolina, and on May 6th at Salem College in Winston-Salem. Visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for additional concert dates. Rex McGee joined David Ford for a conversation last fall, along with guitarist John Garris and cajon player Bobby Martin.
Rex, last we spoke, you told a little about your connection with this great music, string band music, and it goes way, way back.
There's a lot of family history. This is humorously referred to it as a family curse. I'm a fiddle player of many generations of McGee fiddle players, and my grandpa was a big influence in making me want to play the fiddle and this kind of music.
Just hearing him play, and you got the itch at what age was it?
I would have had my first violin lessons when I was 4 years old. Okay. But the violin lessons weren't what excited me as much as seeing him play the old-time fiddle, and so probably took till my teenage years before I really gravitated towards his music and really digging in and learning old-time tunes on the fiddle.
Interesting. And Bobby, how about yourself? When did you get involved with percussion?
I was sort of a different case. I was raised in a bluegrass family, bluegrass music from both sides, mom and dad and the family.
Whereabouts, Bobby?
Originally from Salisbury, NC. Uh-huh. Live in Union Grove now. And it was really weird because I traveled a number of years on the road playing country and different things out west and up through Canada.
And drum set?
On a drum set. And then I came back to my roots, so to speak, and hooked up with some great musicians, acoustic musicians, and I made a turn towards that acoustic sound.
Well, I want to talk about that acoustic sound in the cajon in just a minute, but first I'm going to turn the mic over to John and get his, entree into this world. I mean, fine picker, and where did it all begin for you, John?
I mostly remember my grandparents playing guitar on my mom's side and some harmonica on my dad's side. Kind of funny, I had a bunch of harmonica players in the family. But
how about that?
Yeah, it's kind of different.
You all are invested in it. And this new album, I mean, it just blew me out of the water. Congratulations.
Thank
for
you.
Starters.
Thank
just
you.
Great tunes.
Thanks.
A lot of original music and just fantastic performances. And you keep that live sound, that kind of like in-the-moment sound, which I love so much. Huh. For the listeners not in the know, tell me about a cajon. What is
cajon?
It?
It's a Peruvian instrument. It's a wood box. It's got different tones that you can bring out and play. And you got your high end, where it would be like a snare. And then your low end would be like a kick on a bass drum. And I do a lot of brushwork on the cajon instead of using my hands, because it allows me to get the tones that I want for acoustic music.
Well, and this project really was a perfect vehicle for that, because you all are set up to really capture that live jamming sound. Rex, talk about the dynamic at Mitch Easter's place there, the Fidelitorium, and what was that like for y'all?
We had originally thought about recording this in my living room at home. I was working full-time as a pharmacist and was going to try to squeeze this thing in one weekend of being off. And he, Brent Lambert, immediately, you know, recognized there would be some technical challenges with working in the living room. And he said, you know, you don't do that many things like this. It'll be your first solo release in 13 years. Why not pony up and go to a real studio somewhere? And I said, so he talked me into it. And Mitch's place was on the short list right away. So we went there, and it was a very nice, relaxed vibe. And Brent was very well set up with an impressive array of microphones. And their equipment was very much up to the task of allowing us to just sit around in one room, much like we would around a campfire. In this case, the campfire was the microphone array.
So. Love that. Yeah. Now, that without doing lots of punch-ins and whatnot, that must add a little pressure to the situation. But, I mean, you handled it well.
That's
but
right.
What was the scene like?
There were no punches. It was just we would do takes, much the way probably things were recorded in the 50s and 60s before a lot of multi-tracking at the end of the day selected from the best of, you know, four or five takes that we had.
All right.
But I really worked these guys to death for those 2 days because we tracked 13 tunes, and you can do the math. You know, four or five takes for each one ends up being about 50-some takes that we amassed in 2 days of work. And
that's a long day.
I'm lucky to be alive after these guys were staring me down.
Well, right off the gate, you get a sense of the excitement of that process with first track on the album, Jesse's Jam Cakes. When you're playing in the studio like that, you're not in front of a campfire. Can you get yourself in that place like we're jamming?
Yeah, once the music starts, then you're there. You're in front of the campfire again. Many ways to approach recording, doing a recording project, and one might be the perfectionist approach where you're looking for everybody to get that perfect take. And frankly, you know, there are no perfect takes where everybody got every second of every song right on this album. You're going to be able to find, you know, misses, hits, and flubs here and there, but more of the focus was capturing that energy of spontaneity.
Yeah.
And the excitement of really playing the music, not just doing a clinical operation where you make sure everything's perfect.
Are they all originals?
Most of these are originals. Now, I will say some of them are more taken from traditional tunes. I think immediately of the song Cripple Creek, which, of course, we named Cripple Crunk. We're trying to do it, trying to keep everything youthful and funny here.
Yeah,
so there's some traditional tunes that we just do some very stylized versions of. I wanted to cover a lot of the influence of a lot of different genres. As we typically did to keep ourselves entertained growing up playing with each other, we wouldn't, I guess, likes gravitate towards likes. And a lot of my friends that I made playing music were people like-minded that wanted to play other styles.
Well, that's a perfect segue into the track two. Just right, I mean, this one, talking about Crunkberry Blossom, you get some funky, crunky grooves on that bad boy. Who are some of your all's crossover influences? Because it really brings it into a different realm.
Yeah, that was an idea of reharmonizing an old fiddle tune. Really, the Crunkberry Blossom, it takes Blackberry Blossom, and we just I added some harmonies and slowed it down, and Bobby's got a funkier groove on the percussion. It's almost a shame for me to claim credit for arranging and composing a lot of this stuff. It's happened in so much as a group effort, but it got enormously complicated if I tried to be completely accurate.
The magic was there. The magic was there.
You could tell. No, know, how many times have you heard bands that have tried to be eclectic or tried to embrace different styles? It's seamless on this album. That's what I love it so much.
That's kind of the rule, is you just didn't want to stop that from happening.
Yeah, exactly.
That was kind of the goal, is to make sure that you just didn't step on the toes of the spontaneity part, you know.
Yeah.
And I think what helped that was probably Brent's idea of putting up the large array of mics and stuff like that, and then throwing that into the nice room mix when you're done.
Well, at the heart of it all are great performances, and I guess on this particular tune, talking about Crunkberry Blossom, I love Nate Leith's playing on this. The fiddle solos are, again, kind of in keeping with the whole project, just the variety of sounds he's getting in the thing.
Being a fiddle player myself, fiddle players are notoriously persnickety about other fiddle players, you know, as far as your taste of who you like and who you don't. But Nate really grew up with our school of playing, if there is such a thing, where you've got people that are versatile and able to cross over into different genres. And he was just an amazing prodigy as a young kid, winning Galax Fiddlers Convention when he was, what, like 10 years old?
I knew Nate when he was 7 and 8 years old, and he was a child prodigy then. And we became friends a long time ago. And
once he was old enough to stay up late and after midnight, you know, he learned all the bad habits that these guys do. And he really went on to a Berklee School of Music there in Boston and became a well-trained musician. And he's probably the most literate of all the guys on the road.
That's funny you mentioned the Berklee thing. I didn't realize. I'm hearing a little Tommy Gerald, and all of a sudden it's Stefan Grappelli. And all, this is the same, or John Blake. It's like the same guy. He's
totally the perfect guy for the project. Nate Leith is
fantastic.
Amazing players.
Privilege working with him.
Love the title, Jig of Retribution, Rome Mountain Grown. And again, speaking of the variety in the album, what are some of the common threads that you need to get right? And you're talking about how persnickety you are as a fiddler, hiring a fiddler. Any of you guys can chime in on this. Yeah, you're doing a whole bunch of different styles of music, but what you got to get right to make it all work as a whole?
I can say, when you sit down with quality musicians that were on this CD, the magic happens.
You could get technical about answering the question, saying that everybody plays with good tone and good timing and the appropriate taste for whatever genre we're in at the moment. But it's also, you could take any one of these genres, and maybe a purist within that genre would say something's a little strange about the way these guys are doing it. But by the time you mix them all together, it's sort of its own sound. And
either
you like it or you don't. But
Jig of Retribution is a great tune, and I love the switch in tempo. That up-tempo
jig to a reel. Jig to a reel. So that always is a cheat trick that works.
I mean, we're locking the tempo with you there, Bobby, where it shifts into the jig?
Yes.
The reel, from the jig to the reel?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm talking about. We were, to myself, I was reading off of these guys, you know, because, I mean, the tempos and the changes. It was a good tune to work with.
I mean, the music's great, the compositions are great, and the titles are great. Can we go back to the letter K and Cripple Crunk?
There we go.
Great tune. And these are all, again, so many of these originals or you know, arrangements by Rex. I love the combination of just the seriousness in terms of the musicality, the musicianship in this, but there's always lightheartedness in it, and it comes across in this tune. You don't hear trading twos that often in bluegrass, and you get it on this tune. Speak to that, the humor element in some of these things.
Danny is quite a humorous fellow, the mandolin guy. My partner Danny nicely goes back to gosh, us getting in all kinds of musical mischief up at Galax when we were teenagers.
Okay.
And Danny lives in Northern Virginia, and he is a band leader in his own right. He's traveled the world and involved with many different projects. And yeah, he's a funny guy as well, and so it can't help but come out. I really think this idea of, yeah, like you say, trading twos might have came out of a jam session at Galax a couple years ago where we, you know, sometimes you're not in the mood to play Cripple Creek like wide open fast. Instead, you want to just play a little funky version of it. And so
we can sit
here and have a musical conversation, you know, back and forth between two or three of us. You know.
Well, let's hear some of that. It's the perfect ending. I mean, I laughed out loud. My office mate just said, "David, are you okay?" I mean, it's
the Bo Diddley ending, right?
You got to have that. That's awesome. All right. And that's a Cripple Crunk. That's the title cut, as they say. Cripple Crunk, 13 doses of instrumental musical medicine. I love it. There's one tune that on the album that's got a slow groove on it, and it was real bluesy, talking about TNBABCB. What is that, T?
That is an acronym.
I had a
feeling. You know what an acronym that is?
Can we say this on NPR radio?
You can absolutely. Yeah, it's not anything you might would think it would be. It is, there'll never be another Brown County Breakdown, which Brown County Breakdown is a famous Bill Monroe tune that's usually done a lot quicker. It's a breakdown.
Oh,
so we slowed it up and paired it with the great There'll Never Be Another You jazz classic. So we took the changes from a jazz tune and took the melody head from a bluegrass tune, slowed it down, and it's this obscure. And this, I think, was Danny's brainchild, actually. I might have changed his arrangement a little bit, but just one of those freaks of nature.
A lot of fun playing everything with everybody. It's tough when you're dealing with health issues sometimes, but at the same time, when you get around music like that, it just carries you right through.
Music's the best medicine.
It is.
There it is. And Rex, I can't let you off the hook on that one, because I could have sworn I was, and this is for early on in the plane here, I thought, God, what does this remind? Is it Earl Klug? Is it George Benson? And then all of a sudden, you came in with some scat singing on
there
that
you go.
Solo.
Yeah, that's, you just have to feel that sort of thing. You can't plan that moment. See, I thought that was going to be an outtake for sure, and that nobody would have used it. But at the end of the day, again, humor wins. So.
Oh, I don't think Bella Flex tried that out yet. That's awesome. That's innovative.
He's a smarter man than
me. Oh, come on.
Not always evident to everybody that there's a tune in every key, so there's a little nod to Bach there. If you start, the first tune is in G, and they go all the way up through G sharp, so in chromatic order. So there's a technical detail that's...
A little well-tempered crunk?
A little bit of well-tempered crunk going on.
But hiding some of these things. You can't tell everybody all the secrets.
Yeah, I got it. Well, nobody had ever figured it out otherwise. But then you get to the last tune, and that last tune actually modulates through all 12 keys in that one tune, and it also summarizes a lot of the styles we did in the rest of the tunes on the album. So you've got the melody to a traditional fiddle tune called Did You Ever See the Devil, Uncle Joe, which comes from the Irish repertoire of Miss McLeod's Reel. And we just modulate after, initially every 32 bars, and then it starts shrinking down near the end where we're modulating every 16 bars and every 18 bars. And so we cover all the keys, and we do it in different styles as we pass through. We play more bluegrassy, old-timey, Irishy, swing, Cajun, a little R&B. So it's the last tune summarizes the project.
Rex McGee, Bobby Martin, and John Garris. They're three members of the acoustic instrumental collective known as Cripple Crunk. You can hear them live in concert on May 3rd at Five String Fest in Lawndale, NC, and on May 6th at Salem College in Winston-Salem. Visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for additional concert dates. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We have to take a short break, but stick around, because up next we take a look at the immigration debate, but through an artistic lens, thanks to the work of Faith Action International House. Then later it's a conversation with jazz legend Wayne Shorter, all when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia, in for David Ford. Over the last 18 years, Faith Action International House has served and accompanied over 30,000 new immigrants, while educating and connecting tens of thousands more. Their mission is to turn strangers into neighbors and to create a better community for all Greensboro residents. Recently, the Greensboro City Council unanimously passed a resolution honoring the work of Faith Action International House, making Greensboro the nation's first stranger-to-neighbor city. Faith Action keeps a full calendar, and their next Stranger to Neighbor dialogue is called Building Bridges Through Soccer, and it takes place on Wednesday, April 23rd at Westminster Presbyterian Church in Greensboro. Check WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for additional events. One of the many ways they open dialogues in our community is by holding musical and theatrical events. Last fall, David Fracaro and Andy Mendez stopped by to talk with David Ford about Out of the Shadows, stories of hope and courage from our newest immigrant neighbors.
Brother still sleepy, grumbles, it's not light yet. If you want a new life, what's a few minutes wait?
What's the mission of Faith Action International House, David?
Faith Action serves thousands of new immigrants each year, while also educating and connecting our diverse community across lines of culture and faith, turning strangers into neighbors.
I like that phrase, turning strangers into neighbors. Well, arts is a big part of Faith Action International. I mean, the music, a universal language, what have you, but Out of the Shadows, stories of courage and hope from our newest immigrant neighbors. What was the genesis of this production?
Well, in the midst of this tremendous new diversity in our community, again, it's no longer happening just in huge cities like New York, LA, or Chicago, but increasingly this tremendous new influx of immigrants is happening in places like Omaha, Dayton, and Greensboro. And at Faith Action, we essentially say our community has a choice to make. Are we going to fear one another as strangers or embrace one another as neighbors? And so how do you go about truly turning a stranger into a neighbor without it just being some kind of a hokey tagline? And it really starts with education, so people aren't dealing with myths about people, but facts. And they're also dealing face-to-face with someone who is a new immigrant, and they're listening to their stories. Thankfully, we have the arts to help tell those stories. And so what we've done is we've taken 10 stories from folks that we've served and walked with at Faith Action, stories of tremendous struggle in terms of the journey story, leaving one country, coming to another, and at the same time, the tremendous hope and courage and resilience that has occurred through that journey story. And so our 10 stories really capture all of that in the immigrant experience, and it's something we're privileged to see and experience every day at Faith Action.
And now, how is this incorporating into the One City, One Book initiative?
I think every other year they do a One City, One Book project where the entire city will read a book. And this year, in the midst of our tremendous new diversity, they thought it was important and timely to do a book called Into the Beautiful North, about a young woman's journey from small town Mexico into the United States. And it's a compelling book full of sadness and humor and resilience and courage. And we knew that we had thousands of these stories right here in Greensboro to tell, some of the most incredible stories that each deserve their own movie. So at the least we could do is share these tremendous stories with our greater public at the Upstage Cabaret space at the Triad Stage.
And we've got one of those stories from a big town girl to the United States, about as big as it gets, Mexico, DF, Mexico City.
Yes, sir.
And Andy Mendez here to talk about it. First off, Andy, what do you do at Faith Action House?
A little bit of everything. I'm the administrative assistant, mm-hmm. and also starting the Latino outreach and education.
This project has a lot of relevance in your life. Could you describe your current family situation?
I'm the mother of a mixed status family. I'm the first action. My daughters are U.S. citizens, born here, and my husband is an undocumented immigrant.
In addition to your activities at Faith Action, you've been a very vocal proponent for immigration reform, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your D.C. trip. Describe the dynamic, and what did you say to these people?
I just told them my story as an immigrant. I just told them why I was brought here and, you know, what it meant to me while they were waiting to take a decision if they're going to support or not immigration reform, how it was affecting me directly on my daily basis life, how it was affecting my husband and how it was affecting my daughter, which is a U.S. citizen here.
Could you share some of those stories with us? I mean, how does that status impact you on a daily basis?
Just the fact, since you wake up and you have to say goodbye to your husband because he has to go to work from 6 to 8 every day, you're afraid that he might be stopped. And because he doesn't have a driver's license, he might be deported as the hundreds of people that get deported every day. The fact of seeing my daughter graduating from pre-K, you know, is something very simple, but it takes such emotional thorn on you that that you dream that one day she's going to graduate from college. And due to your situation, you know, you were not able. So it's a great moment as a mother, but as a human being, you know, you're like, a little ouchy there.
David, how does Out of the Shadows convey these sorts of stories?
These stories help people understand the desperate circumstances that many people flee, that it's oftentimes a matter of survival, not only just a shot at a better life, but legitimate survival, and that most people don't want to potentially overstay a visa or be seen as a problem. And I assure you, moms don't want to be potentially walking 3 days in the desert. And they're fleeing one traumatic situation and then having to go through a brand new traumatizing situation by crossing the desert and then living with that fear in the United States. I mean, those come across as very sad, sorrowful stories full of dramatic flavor. But what's remarkable is that in all of these stories, you get another side to see the courage and the hope and the resilience that's in the human spirit. That's what great drama's made of. Mano negra clandestina,
peruano clandestino. Put me in the audience.
Most people, if they went to high school, saw a production of Our Town. It was very bare, very simple. This is just a bare brick stage in the background with people getting up from a chair and telling a story honestly. No thrills about it, no major set or movement. And these are immigrant actors themselves who have a very close connection to this issue. So we're not going with professional trained actors. We're going with people who know these stories, who have their own story to tell as well. Aquí estoy establecido en los Estados Unidos.
10 años pasaron ya. Could we hear a monologue?
My name is Erendira Mendez, well known as Andy. Andy Mendez. I'm an immigrant myself from Mexico City. Been in the country 13 years. I'm the daughter of two. I have a brother, a little younger brother. And we were brought here to reunite with my dad after finding out he had a job-related accident, which caused him to lose his leg. And as a family, we needed to be there. And after several attempts of trying to come to the country the correct way, we were in a desperate situation and we decided to walk 3 days through the desert. A situation where it will scar you for life. It was so dark at night, you couldn't see your own hand. And it was so hot, and you quickly realized it was not a venture that you thought it was going to be. We made it to the country and we adapted. We start feeling like we belong here. Of course, we went through the situation in high school, finding out that, you know, we didn't, what it meant not to have a social security. And my dad is the type of person that always, since we were younger, education is going to give you success in life. And that's why we came here, you know. He came to the country to give us that opportunity, you know, to provide money in our country, to give us a good education. Due to the situation we encounter ourselves, we came to the country, right? And that was his dream, you know. And within a week, he put us in school, you know. So education, it was really important. And now you're told you're not allowed to get education. And it was really traumatizing. I guess you come to the point of your life, you resign yourself to what's going on. And you just get waitress's job. Every job is a decent job. But, you know, when you knew you had skills for more. My brother then took it as well. He was held up last week. And he went back 2 years ago because he wanted to study engineering, which was really expensive, and he paid out-of-state tuition here. And he was just tired of being told, we don't want you here, you don't belong here. He was tired of getting paid minimum wage and being overworked as a cook, you know, and he knew he couldn't complain because what else could he do? So he left, and last week you get to that point that you want to be there for him. What if something happened to him? Something happened to him already. And you're not there. You cannot drop anything. I have my family here. I have my little one. If I go there, how can I help him if I don't have a job there? And this theater project, I think, is a great opportunity to people to hear the other side, to really understand it. Just to give that opportunity, you know, it's just a simple hello, how are you? Or even if you don't understand their English or accent, just make it an effort. It will make a big difference in someone else's life because, you know, they might have a rough morning, you know?
Just a quick note that on the way back from Washington, D.C., which was an incredible trip to see the potential of America through new immigrants' eyes, but the most meaningful part for me was on the ride home. It's a long, kind of boring ride at night, 6 hours. And we were just talking. I was the only white Caucasian citizen in the car and speak a little bit of Spanish, but not great. And so we were just chatting, and I was just saying, you know, what is it really going to take for legitimately strangers to become neighbors? Because most of us don't have a friend across those lines of differences. And so I just asked somebody, and I didn't get some kind of straight up answer or theory or, you know, dissertation. This guy just said in the back seat, let me tell you a story. He said, when my sister and I had to walk across the desert, we came here, we moved to Reidsville, you know, a very small farming community way far away from downtown Greensboro. And they moved into this very small, predominantly white Caucasian farming community, this family from Mexico. And they put their child into school right away. I think he was in fourth grade or something like that. And they were having trouble understanding how to do his homework, how to help the child with the homework. So they went to their neighbor's home, this elderly white Caucasian farming couple, and knocked on the door and in kind of very broken English essentially said, would you at all be able to help my son with his math? And this elderly couple greeted them with a smile and invited them in. And despite the lack of language in common and culture in common, they used a lot of nonverbals and they helped that child move forward in school. And the family from Mexico helped repay that family who was elderly with by mowing their lawn and making meals. And over time, you had this beautiful relationship start to develop where they're eating together and they were starting to see one another not only as neighbors but as family. And they grew together and lived next to one another for years like that. And then this older gentleman got close to the end of his life and he knew it was coming. And he called his Mexican neighbors over and said, you know, my life's coming to an end, but I want you all to take care of my wife after I pass on. And they ended up not only doing that, but actually carrying this man's casket at his funeral. And I bet you in the United States right now, those kind of stories are fairly rare, but they are out there. They just don't get told all that often. But those stories are gold.
Ay, qué bonita es mi tierra, te lo digo, compañero. Ay, qué bonita es mi tierra, que lo sepa el mundo entero.
David Fracaro and Endy Mendez. Faith Action International House was recently named the nation's first Stranger to Neighbor City. Their next Stranger to Neighbor dialogue is called Building Bridges Through Soccer, and it takes place on Wednesday, April 23rd at Westminster Presbyterian Church in Greensboro. Check WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for additional events. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We need to take one last 60-second break, and when we come back, we'll be treated to David Ford's conversation with a living legend of jazz, Mr. Wayne Shorter. So stay with 88.5 WFDD as Triad Arts Weekend continues in just a moment. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia, in for David Ford. Our next guest has been characterized by the New York Times as being jazz's greatest living composer. Now, those words carry weight, but they rest softly on the shoulders of renowned jazz saxophonist Wayne Shorter. From jamming with John Coltrane, to Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, to his days with Miles Davis, to the groundbreaking fusion band Weather Report, his musical resume is no joke. The 80-year-old Shorter has reunited with Blue Note Records, the label that championed him as a bandleader back in the 1960s. On his latest album, Without a Net, he leads a quartet that he's been collaborating with for the past decade. The album helped Shorter to win Musician of the Year, Best Album, and Top Midsize Ensemble from the 2014 Jazz Awards. And at this year's Grammys, Shorter took home the Golden Gramophone for Best Improvised Jazz Solo for his composition, Orbits. Wayne Shorter visited the Triad back in 2012, performing at Waite Chapel at a fundraiser for the Amazon Aid Foundation. Before he floored Winston-Salem audiences with his performance, he had a conversation with Triad Arts resident Wayne Shorter's superfan, David Ford.
And so there they are once again, the wonderful sounds that come out of the great Charlie Parker All-Star Organization, and to wind their little part of the deal up, let's hear, well, it's a privilege to hear the birds sing, Salt Peanuts.
It was like hearing something on the radio, you know, while I was an art major at Arts High School. I heard about the invasion, if you might call it like that, of a new kind of music called bebop. Some of the older residents in New Jersey, they were saying names, Charles Christopher Parker and Miles Dewey Davis, and at the same time, listening to a lot of musical, you know, scores, all these things started to come together. Since I was an art major, the musical path is like a physical involvement, sort of like interacting with people, with exciting new innovation in the art world, where you can move around and had to interact with what I was hearing on the radio. And also, at the same time, I was collecting records from the library, Stravinsky, not just the modern thing, but you know, really opening up to the value of Mozart and Beethoven.
Was this all before you even picked up the clarinet? Was this in your teen years and all these things were coming to a head for you?
Practically at the same time, simultaneously, I got a clarinet and started taking clarinet lessons, but I would stop at the library and stay till the library closed. And way in the back rooms reading stuff about, you know, musicians 17th, 18th century and the difficult time that they had, even though they had patrons of the arts in those times, all that stuff. And I was thinking about the whole social implications with the influx of progressive jazz, bebop, and how difficult it was to keep it on the radio. There was an effort to curtail the introduction of this music on the airways. So talk about, you know, it sounded like chicken scratch and sounded like a lot of mistakes. And at the same time, I was thinking about the time when people threw tomatoes at the first the Rite of Spring in Paris. Then, you know, I was thinking about, you know, the difficulty of moving things forward, not just for the sake of art, but for the sake of the opening of humanity's eyes to change.
Hmm. I think of your music, I mean, your compositions as having moved that whole conversation forward in so many ways. So many of the pieces that I love that you've written have become jazz standards. I'm just going to list off a few for listeners. Footprints, Nefertiti, Speak No Evil, Night Dreamer. They're so unique. What do you think has made them standards, Mr. Shorter? And what do you, just from your take on these great tunes that we all love.
Well, you know, when we recorded it back in the 60s, myself, Lee Morgan, and I would be in the studio recording stuff. And after we sitting there thinking about 20 years hence, we would say, what is this stuff going to be like? We were thinking like maybe this whole the efforts that we're doing might be dead and buried 20 years from now. So we said, well, let's do the best we can. So I'm not even thinking that we were aware of something magically in the works that would take hold to the generations, because, you know, there was so much resistance to the popularity. You know, like, how many hits do you have in the world that's really, unless it stands the test of time, is still not at a place where you get masses of listeners and masses of people who ask for, I mean, music that's out of the comfort zone of their lives, you know, stuff that they hear every day on the radio. You know, the band I'm working with now, we kind of play stuff that is unpredictable because we don't rehearse. We don't know what we're going to do. I always say to myself, how do you rehearse the unknown? But then maybe that's what we have to do, deal with the unknown so that we can learn how to stay on our feet and not fall down or fall flat. Because if we're out of our comfort zone, you know, we're all going to be astronauts and learn to dialogue with the unexpected.
Tell me about that, Mr. Shorter, because I love your quote in Ben Radcliffe's book, The Jazz Year, when you say you don't listen to music much because there aren't that many close sequences of chance-taking over any period of time. You said you have to wait until someone has the courage to come and jump into the deep water. And just as you're talking about there, to my ears, when I hear you play, you're jumping into deep water all the time, and now with your bandmates with this group. What's that feel like, and what's your mindset going into that big jump in performance when you're up on stage?
You need to make yourself vulnerable on stage. You can't try to put all of your musical training and the foundation that you have in music. Don't worry about putting all that on display. You're going to have train wrecks, maybe, and you're going to actually even demonstrate struggle when you're dealing with without rehearsal. But after the struggle, you got to try to break through to something called victory. The audience has been going with us, and after we finish, they say, we felt this struggle in certain places and everything, and then you broke through the sunshine. This audience that we've been playing to in Europe and lately in the United States, all relatively young. I mean, young. I mean, talking about when we had Weather Report, 15-year-olds at the end, when I left Frederick, you know, we broke up and everything like that.
Yeah.
Age 15, 13, and then Herbie and I did a duet album, and we traveled around. We went as far as Argentina, an album called 1+1.
Yes.
Chile. Young, some gray hairs and people and everything. Don't you remember when people? It's okay. But they, too, know that you're moving on. Sonny Rollins said on a documentary, they asked him, why do you guys play progressive jazz or creative stuff. Why, you know, knowing that, you know, you're not going to have a hit. He said, well, we're playing so-called daring music, not to show off, not to show how great you are with your virtuosity and articulation and razzle-dazzle. That's my word, razzle, you know,
yeah.
Acrobatic, musical acrobatics and all that. He said, we're playing this, you know, new music to be human.
It seems like the struggle that you show in your playing and that vulnerability that you lay out there when you take a solo and now in your bandmates as well, but I'm thinking about you when I'm saying I've always loved that aspect of your playing, and I can see how that would be very attractive to a young audience looking for people to keep it real, as they're saying today. I think of a recent recording, not that recent now, we're going back 10 years to the Footprints Live, and the experimental way you all approach that, it's exciting stuff.
Here's what I say. There's no such thing to me as a finished piece of music. You just stop writing until you tend to go on. And the comment is like, oh, someone is reinventing themselves. Reinventing. I don't think about no reinventing. I just think they're continuing. And they're not just the same anymore. You continue. So I don't let the words like reinvent stop the music that I've been working on. It's unfinished. And it will appear again, grown up.
If you listen to this recording you did with John Patitucci and Danilo Perez and Brian Blade of Footprints in 2005, if you would have heard that recording back in 1966, you would have just thought, well, that's just a natural extension.
Yeah. This moving on, it's supposed to kind of communicate something to the audience that you don't have to discard something because you think it has no value, but you can graduate. I'm dealing with not letting the illusion of something take me away from what we call the mission. The illusion of something will stop some people. The illusion of getting older, say, well, I can't do that young stuff anymore. Those are my dreams, my young dreams, my childish dreams. It's not possible. So what I'm dealing with is that, yes, it is. It's possible. Let's go to fantasy land. And it's possible that reality is a fantasy, and the fantasy is the real reality. Yes, they did live happily ever after. You do live a happily ever after. We are eternal. We just go to sleep, we go on vacation, and then we wake up and continue.
I want to talk a little bit about this great band that's coming to Winston-Salem, but going back, you made your recording debut as a band leader back in 59. I'm wondering how your leadership style has grown or evolved over the years.
Thinking about the group that we have now with Danilo Perez and John Patitucci and Brian Blade, they're band leaders. Danilo goes out with his band and Patitucci and Brian Blade, of course. And then when we're on stage, it's a group of band leaders sort of saying, this is the time for every individual to be self-led, and that adage about too many cooks in the kitchen is a lie. A lot of cooks in the kitchen can work now, because the kitchen is the whole universe.
I can't wait to hear you all perform, but I mean, I'm just having seen each of you individually over the years. I just imagine the listening that goes on between you just must be at an incredible level.
When something's going on and someone cuts through what everyone else is doing, in the past, maybe it was taken as an interruption. Oh, you're interrupting my solo. But now it's like a benefit. It's like a donation to the mission. Then we have to interpret this donation musically, and the part of the dialogue and saying, oh, thank you, let me travel with you, you know. And some people have been seeing that. They say, hey, John was taking a bass sort of like a solo or something like that, and then the piano came in and cut right through there, and then John just joined in. he's going left, and he went right with the piano. Then the drum made a big loud boom. Then you all got inside the boom.
Inside the boom. I love it.
Yeah, because they were saying they see pictures. And so we do like a 90-minute concert. At the end, we get comments like, wow, if there's more, that was short. So we're saying, maybe that's like, if it's really happening, if it's good, it feels short. If it's not happening, it's really long.
Jazz saxophonist and composer Wayne Shorter. Mr. Shorter's latest album, Without a Net, helped him win Musician of the Year, Best Album, and Top Midsize Ensemble at the 2014 Jazz Awards. And at this year's Grammys, Shorter took home the Golden Gramophone for Best Improvised Jazz Solo for his composition, Orbits. Visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend to find out more about this jazz legend. Well, that wraps up today's show. Our executive producer is David Ford. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Andre Wallace. If you missed part of today's episode or would like to share what you heard, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can find us on Twitter, too. Our handle is Triad Arts Speak. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions to share, please send your email to triadarts@wfu.edu. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.